The Saskatchewan Healthcare Coalition is hosting the All for Public Healthcare Rally in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, May 4th. It's free and you're invited. This rally is happening because our public healthcare system does not have the support it needs to meet the diverse needs of all Saskatchewan residents. For years, it has been underfunded, ignored, and hindered, so join Donna and I in person on May 4th in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan for a walk, speeches, networking, and community building. Link for more information is in the show notes. Hope to see you there. There is a pile of good research about addictions out there that is simply sitting on a shelf doing nothing.
We're looking at 7.5 billion people in the world with 7.5 different sets of DNA. Yet we think we're going to treat everybody the same.
We're going to lock you up and shove the 12 steps down your throat. And there, you're good. In this episode, I talked to neuroscientist and TED Talk speaker Dr. Evelyn Higgins about the neuroscience of addiction.
But there's always a co-occurring disorder. What made you start that behavior to begin with?
Starting her career as a service provider in pain management, Evelyn quickly saw the need for better information. Today she works on projects including entire recovery-oriented high schools to working with convicts and reducing recidivism related to substance use disorder.
If recidivism is constant, doesn't it make sense while you have someone to say, let's make changes within this individual? So when they get out, they're not back 5 minutes later.
What's up, everybody? My name's Dan, podcaster, keynote speaker, and advocate, and this is Hard Knocks Talks, your addictions podcast. Now, let's get into my talk with Dr. Evelyn Higgins. Evelyn, how are you?
I'm well, Daniel. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining me. One thing that definitely stood out to me the most when I first came across you was your history in pain management and mm-hmm. what part about that brought you to the work you do today. So why don't we jump off there? Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So some 35 years ago, practicing pain management, and I was initially in a rural area mm-hmm. and seeing in an interdisciplinary setting and seeing people being prescribed with a try this, try that approach. If it doesn't work, we'll half it, we'll double it, we'll change it. All symptom based and based mm-hmm. on somebody's vocabulary.
Hang on a second. Now you said based on someone's vocabulary. Unpack that for me. What do you mean by that?
Okay. So, you know, Daniel, what if you and I don't have the same vocabulary for describing what we're feeling?
Mm.
How do we wind up in the right place? There was nothing objective. It was all subjective.
Right. So we're talking about a breakdown in communication.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, then, and that's in a rural area. 20 years after that, I'm in an urban area and I'm like, well, maybe things will be a little bit more progressive. Maybe things will be different. And they weren't. It was the same exact try this, try that, half it, double it. If it's not working, let's throw it back on the patient, telling them it's them and this is the way they want to be.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, nothing had changed. While technology was evolving, it wasn't being brought in to this area.
Why did you leave the rural area? Did you just not like how things were going? You thought we were looking for something more progressive or?
Yeah, all of it, kind of personal, professional, all of it, you know, and maybe things could be more advanced. Maybe we could uh-huh. be doing more things. And it just wasn't that way. It was the same exact model. Time had marched on, but nothing had changed.
Mm-hmm. And you have a personal reason for doing this as well. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Sure, sure. So that was professional. Personal was I had married an alcoholic. Mm. A year after our daughter was born, we found out that he was adopted. So now there were all of these other additional layers to, okay, I have a child. What do I need to know? Because I was seeing his behavior. It was, you know, who's showing up today? Who's showing up in this hour?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as a parent, you start to look at things like, what do I need to know? What do I need to do moving forward? What do I need to look out for? And again, you know, seeing this, nothing had evolved mm-hmm. and technology was not being used to advance anything within the addiction space, within the mental health space, which is really the big umbrella of everything that we're talking about. And to me, that was ridiculous, you know, And why was that?
So you were looking for, I mean, you had a child and now you were looking for genetic markers in family history. Sure. Is that what the challenge was there?
Family history, genetic markers. Like if you already see what could be the future because of genetic links, like let's do as much as we can do mm-hmm. and potentially change the outcome of a situation.
So you're suggesting that there is in fact a genetic predisposition to substance use disorder?
A genetic predisposition as far as the perfect storm could be set up.
Okay.
You know, it's what biomarkers are we looking at? And in reality, so we're kind of jumping into this hard, Daniel. That's how you do your show.
Let's go, hard knocks.
Let's go, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, your DNA, here's your cards, you're born with it, play your cards out. But now with the study of epigenetics, which to me is the most fascinating part of what's happening in science today, is that we know that the expression of these genes can change, right? So genes can be turned on, can be turned off. The expression can change. That's where it gives the power back to the individual to saying, this doesn't have to be my lifelong legacy. You know, but it starts with we have to have objective data. We have to have biomarkers. We have to say, what is your starting point? And to that point, you know, people say, how come I never saw this behavior in my child until 21 years old? 20 years, I saw a different kid. Okay, well, what happened at 20? What happened at 21? Tell me what's going on in their life. Well, they went to college for the first time. They had a part-time job while they were trying to navigate their studies. They didn't have anybody telling them, hey, is that really a good thing to do? Do you need to be doing this? You know, so everything in that person's environment had changed. So while these genes still existed in them, we never saw the expression of those genes, right? So even from a preventative standpoint, if knowing just like anything else, you know, should if someone has, say, breast cancer in their family, should we not look at the BRCA genes for them? You know, so it doesn't mean it's going to happen, but it means we should have the knowledge, just like any other process in healthcare, any other disease, we should have the knowledge of, okay, I just want you to know this. So as you go through your life, you might make different decisions, which is actually like what my TED talk was about. You know, if you had this knowledge in your life, would you make different decisions knowing? And we still all have free will.
If you haven't seen Evelyn's TED Talk, Google it up. I watched it this morning. Great talk. It's only about 7 minutes, so it's not a big time commitment, but it's like drinking from a fire hose.
Exactly. It's like taking a lot of information, making it as simple as possible because, you know, I don't want to talk over anybody. I want to talk with people. To me, the perfect world is if you change a child's life, how many lives are affected by that child's life being better?
Yeah. So you're suggesting that knowing that these genetic predispositions exist can help us tune the child's environment as the to prepare them for to better prepare them for the things that might be coming.
Right. And environment meaning everything from, you know, the people that we associate with to our stress responses to what's going in our life, to what we're putting into our body. To is our environment that we sleep, that we don't sleep, that we exercise, that we don't exercise. Do we have anything healthy in our environment? You know, that's, it's not just the, where am I physically at? The environment is everything.
Yeah. Tell us about the first little while that you started doing research into this in an effort to find a better way.
Sure. So during that whole time while I'm seeing, you know, what are we doing? This is insane. I am in the rural area. So I'm like, I need to further studies in addiction because there's no resources here. You know, we just admired the problem. Well, this is going on. Write it down. Like, what are we going to do about it?
Admire the problem. I like that.
We want to talk about it. We want to admire it, but, you know, take notes on it. But what are we actually doing to change it? So started doing a lot more work so that I personally had tools in the toolbox to use with patients. And that just led to continued studies. And then I became fascinated that we were still practicing in that area like it was 1950.
Yeah.
And the advent of technology was changing. So I really doubled down. all of these things we were doing research on and exploring and seeing that outcomes could be different in people's lives, but we weren't employing the data.
Were you surprised to stumble across all of this data that already existed and like left you sort of wondering, like, why are we not doing anything with it?
Yes, to the point where with one of the professors, I said, it's right here in the textbook. We see how this biochemical reaction works. And they just stared at me and they had co-written the textbook. I'm like, so do you know what's in the textbook? You know, because to me, being a clinician, it was useless information unless we applied it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the power of lived experience, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's like it goes back to, you know, when something gets personal, it's all of a sudden like, well, what are we going to do about it? Great conversation starter. Love the way you're thinking, but what are we going to do about it?
Yeah, yeah. Other than put on our monocles and sip our brandy in the ivory tower.
Right. Good job. Good job.
Oh, look at this marvelous research I've done. Let's put it on the shelf of fame.
Right.
Tell us about the response of your colleagues, the people around you that you were working alongside when you started talking about these things. Was it deer in headlights or were people receptive?
Initially, deer in the headlights. Now, it's the same information, but it's like, whoa, do you know, like, what? I'm like, yeah, we do know, actually. But it's, you know, things like NIDA and the studies that are coming out now and backing everything that we've been saying, that only helps, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what we're here for. So to us, it's like, yes, did you see the new study that came out? This is great. Because then all of a sudden, like, I read a new study. And do you know what it says? It's like, yeah, we do.
So we have this information now. Have there been any implementations of it?
Oh, absolutely.
Conceptualizing?
No, absolutely. From standpoint of individuals coming directly to us, to larger studies, one facility that were, well, they actually have two, two recovery high schools in Florida, where we're doing all of their students. These kids actually go to a special school, a recovery high school, and it's their peer group is all kids in recovery.
Wow.
And we're doing our work with them. So this is all really good stuff. So the traction is gaining and gaining and gaining. We've been into prisons where we do our work. Our COO is the chairman of the board of the Florida Justice. So it's getting everywhere.
Yeah.
And the talk about it and the more and more literature that's coming out in the research is only benefiting the momentum of how things are changing. I've had people ask me, they're like, you know, where do you eventually see this? I said, I'm an optimist. I'm always thinking of the best thing that we could do for the greatest amount of people. I said, it would be just like a CBC, a complete blood count. When you go to your doctor, you would have this done. It would be a baseline. We know this is you. It's like kind of, we have conversations within our families, right? Like, we've got a lot of cancer in our family. Just want you to know that, you know, as you go through your life, you're making these choices. Just know that, you know, we've got a lot of heart disease. So it's important for you to exercise. It's important for you to eat better. You know, I'm only sharing this information because it's there and we don't want to see it happen to you. We have these conversations openly, but when it comes to addiction, whatever kind it be, or whether it just be the blanket health of mental health, it's like shut down.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the greatest conversation someone might have was like in the US, you know, we have Thanksgiving and everybody comes and you share a meal together. And it's like, you know, Uncle Joe, he throws a few back and then he leaves really unhappy and he wants to fight everybody. And there's a family blow up. That's the extent of conversation of, hey, there's a lot of this within our family.
Yeah. Don't
just
be like
a heads
that.
Up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's take a quick break here. And I'm going to acknowledge today's sponsors. The Advancing Interprofessional Management of Substance Use Disorders in Saskatchewan program, or AIMS-SK, is offered through the College of Medicine at the University of Saskatchewan and is designed to deepen healthcare professionals' understanding of substance use to improve health outcomes for individuals with substance use disorders. This program consists of three modules, including the foundations of harm reduction in substance use disorder, opioid use disorder, and alcohol use disorder. If you are a healthcare professional in Saskatchewan and wish to reduce stigma and better serve those with substance use disorder, look for the AIMS-SK link in the description below. If you are struggling with the substance use of a loved one or have tragically lost a loved one to drug-related harms, please reach out to Stronger Together Canada, peer-led support groups by Mums Stop the Harm. If you are looking for help with criminal record suspensions, the Elizabeth Fry Society of Saskatchewan covers all associated costs for women or gender-diverse individuals to apply for criminal record suspensions. Reach out to Chelsea at 306-668-0635. To make contact or to learn more about today's sponsors, or check out our new merch, or if you want to show us some love and buy us a coffee, all of those links are in the show notes below. Now, you are working with, you mentioned you're going into prisons, you're working with youth, you're trying to work with unhoused. What does the education look like around this for, say, professionals who want to deepen their understanding about it?
Because this is, to the average, so cutting edge and so new, mm-hmm. you know, it's looking for, can I take this course? Can I take that course? Looking for. We train our clinicians in what we do, the neuroscience of it. We mm-hmm. also, we just started another branch where we have therapists that are trained in the neuroscience of things. So, you know, someone, take the example of somebody going to therapy repeated long-term and never getting those results, like what's holding up the show? To just use an example, one of the genetic SNPs that we look at, SNP, all right, all that means is single nucleotide polymorphism. What's a polymorphism? An error in genetic coding. That's all there is to it. Don't need any more science, and like that's what's happening. So
are you saying that we're not perfect?
Correct.
From a neuroscientist's perspective, we are not perfect. So if you ever thought that perfection was possible, I want you to know that it is not. Evelyn said so.
You know, and when someone comes back with a lab, I'll just throw this in there and then go back. Someone comes back with a lab that, you know, there's a lot going on. And they're like, wow. I'm like, no, this is actually the good news, because we've isolated and identified. Therefore, we can manage. Had we not done those things, we couldn't. If you came back with the perfect lab, I'd say, you know, Daniel, I don't know how to help you. But we have so much that we can optimize, right? Yeah. And it's all these biochemical pathways. But what I was going to say was, example, one of the SNPs we look at tells us, the would an SSRI with you be effective or less effective? So someone that's got, I can't tell you the amount of times, for decades on an SSRI, an antidepressant, decades of try this, try that, double this one, try that one. And you know what? You just don't want to be bitter. It's all on you. Decades. And do their labs. We see their serotonin is in the tank. There's none. I'm like, you've been on this for how long? It was never going to work with you, because nobody took the deeper dive to see that you've got this genetic SNP and the efficacy of an SSRI is not going to be the same with someone else. Mm-hmm. You know, so what does that do to someone who's been for decades, it must be me? It internalizes emotionally. Yeah. Much. And when you say that wasn't you wanting to be you, this is what's happening in your unique physiology, that exhale, a lot of times there's tears of joy, like whoa.
I can't imagine. Like, I had my own, I've had a few bouts where I'd tried different medications and SSRIs and whatever, and I never ever had success, and to this day I wish that I knew, like, I have anxiety, you know, and I've learned through breath work and through things to manage it, but I'm sure it could be better. But like, I don't even know where to begin to start. You know, you go to the family doctor and they start throwing spaghetti at the wall, right? And I just.
Exactly. And you bring up a great point, Daniel, that there's always a co-occurring disorder, right? Mm-hmm. No one winds up with an addiction, whatever it is, on that day.
Yeah,
it's a spectrum. You're not healthy one day and sick the next, or addicted the next. It's all the living in between that brings us to either end of that spectrum. What does that living look like? There's always a co-occurring disorder. We eat anxiety, we have depression, OCD, ADD, ADHD. Mm-hmm. What makes you reach outside of yourself to self-medicate, not even knowing that's what you're doing? I'm attempting to self-medicate. You don't know that. You just know you're with your buddies. You do something and it's like, whoa, that felt good.
Yeah.
Eureka, I found it.
Yeah, I want to feel good again.
Yeah, initially it works because you're like, whoa, I never had this feeling. I feel so calm. This is great. But it works until it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because now, you know, we get to the addiction part of things. But there's always a co-occurring disorder. What made you start that behavior to begin with? We've got to look at all of those pieces, because unless we figure that part out and we manage that, nothing's going to change. Relapse mm-hmm. is just going to be constant and constant and constant.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about your journey through all of this and what you've learned about reducing stigma along the way.
Sure. So reducing stigma is such a big part of this.
Yeah.
You know, thanks to what you do, you know, and having these open conversations. Absolutely.
Thank you.
And talking about it, like, just like any other part of health. Mental health is health. Behavioral health is health.
Yeah. And I got a bone to pick with organizations who say things like mental health and addictions, as though it's somehow divided.
Yeah. So that stigma, you know, example, if someone had diabetes, we wouldn't say, why are you so weak? Just stop eating that.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, but with addiction, somehow it's okay to say that. And we never look at the, what got you there? What happened to you?
Yeah.
You know, is it a diagnosed condition not being treated properly? Is it an undiagnosed condition? Is it a trauma? Is it 1, 2, 3, all those?
Yeah. And we talked a little bit about this before the show too, when people land with heart disease or with other disorders that are related to a lifetime of poor nutrition, eating junk food, whatever. I'm not an expert in those things. I don't see the same level of stigma in, you got yourself here, you need to get yourself out. Or are they even talking about, well, why did you eat junk food for your entire life, knowing that it's bad for you, you know?
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely correct. So
it's
really having the conversations is where it starts, and then taking that conversation and not letting it end, you know, go like to your listeners, you know, go and then talk to your buddies about it. Keep the conversation going, and then saying, how come we're not employing what we're learning? How come we're not taking the research and making it available to everyone?
When we're talking about stigma, I mean, yes, we can talk about the external coming in, you know, the stigma that is preventing these people from being able to access services or being able to have honest conversations about their challenges. Sure. But that goes inside, too. The stigma exists in my own mind. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say these things out loud because I don't want to be seen as a creep or a whatever, you know?
Right.
So have you done any work? Have you done any anti-stigma work with people who are using substances?
I have not had any kind of formal anti-stigma. That's a great idea. I would like to think every time I'm on a podcast or TV or whatever the case may be, that it becomes an anti-stigma conversation that someone can take with them and say, hey, did you know that there's actually like reasons why all this exists?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe that's a great way to blanket it, but that's exactly what it is. It's mm-hmm. every time we make ourselves vulnerable enough to have these conversations, I think it's kind of like an onion being peeled back.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And I just took 7 years in recovery on February 12th here. So I can definitely relate to what you just said there about the onions being the layers being peeled back. It's something that, like, you don't know what you don't know.
And it's
called unconscious incompetence. When I have a realization, and I've had it even in this last 6 months, I will hear someone say something and all of a sudden, boom, I'm different now, you know, and a whole layer has come back and my identity has changed. I'm not who I was 10 minutes ago. And that's hard to process, whether that's good or bad, right?
You know, I just actually said that exact thing to a young man yesterday, one of the recovery high schools, and we had just done his labs. he relapsed before it. Got his labs back. And what, the minute I saw them, I'm like, this poor guy is struggling, struggling. So when I was talking to him and his mom going over the labs, I said, you know, does this resonate with you? And he said, yes. And the mom's like, absolutely. I said, you know, to the young man, I said, you have been feeling so bad that you don't know what it's like to feel good. Mm. And you just assume everybody goes through their day feeling as bad as you are because that's what you know. I'm like, when you start feeling better, you are going to be shocked at, I cannot believe I existed, mm-hmm. that I went through every day feeling that bad, because you just assume, hey, this is how everybody feels.
Yeah.
And they
yeah.
don't.
Yeah. And even those good realizations, those are challenging. Like, and then comes on like a level of shame or guilt or regret over behaving this way. And it seems so simple now. And it's just like, man, recovery is complex. And this is maybe a little bit off topic, but it's like, do you think that recovery ever ends? Do you think that someone who comes out of a substance use disorder and finds a pathway to wellness and is now stable and a productive member of society and doing these things, do you ever think that it comes to a place of just, now I'm just coping with the human condition and this has nothing to do with addiction?
Yeah, but I think, you know, if now we're going to get philosophical, but aren't we always all dealing with the human condition, right? And hopefully evolving.
That's exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the truth, you know? So it's, everybody's got a different nuance in it, but you're just trying to get to the next step, get to mm-hmm. the next step, get to the next step. And we have to work on ourselves every day. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. it's part of being given the gift of life is to make it the best that it can be.
Yeah. Yeah. And the reason I bring this up, and when we're talking about stigma, is because there are, certain recovery communities that stand by the belief that I'm an addict, I will always be an addict, my name is Dan and I'm an addict type thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering do you think that that's healthy? Like, knowing what you know about these predispositions and things like that, is there ever a place where I am no longer an addict, that I am simply a human being struggling with the human condition?
Yeah, I think so. I think for the same reason, like when a child is little and they're put on ADHD medications and it's like, mm-hmm. you're this.
Now, yeah, now you're the kid on ADHD medication.
Yeah, and they're going to live that. And they're going to live up to that label. That's mm-hmm. how our minds work, right?
Yeah.
So just like, now, you know what? We've got to do a little tweaking here. We got this going on. Everybody's got something. Let's just address it and let's just do it and let's move on. Yeah. And when the whole point of what we do with the looking at people's biochemical pathways after we get the labs back is to not stay in that place. How yeah. are we effectively going to change the end result of these biochemical pathways? Where do they need support? To what level do they need support? So are we changing someone's physiology? Yes. What happens, I call the four pillars of health. We have our physical health, our emotional health, our intellectual health, our spiritual health. They all build on each other. So if we've now got our physiology optimized for the best working that I can be, that's going to affect my emotional health. Because yeah. if I'm not optimized in my physiology, I'm going to struggle.
Falling
in
short.
My emotional, right? Am mm-hmm. I ever going to get to the intellectual and the spiritual health? No, you know, because I'm struggling in the first steps of these things. And, you know, is that what we're seeing in the world today? Is that what we're seeing in the culture today? You bet.
Mm-hmm.
You mm-hmm. bet.
Is there an order to these things? Now, you mentioned the physical and the spiritual and the mental and all that. And the example you used there was the physical. Is that the first what? Step? Mitigating physical?
It is the first step. Right. Right. Okay. And it's also what I'll say, like when I'm doing talks, I'm like, it's also the easiest step because here's what we need to do. It's a matter of fact. Employing that strategy may be different. Right. Mm-hmm. But there's the go-to. Here's what we need to do to change our physiology, to get from here to here. This is what we need to do. Right. And then mm-hmm. unless that physiology is optimized, emotionally, we're never going to be optimized. So once that changes, to your point of that recovery of that person, and now they're struggling with the human condition. Our physiology is better. That's optimized. Now our emotional health is better. That's optimized. We keep on working through. And mm-hmm. to me, the last part of it is the spirituality, because if someone starts out and physiologically they're a mess, spirituality is the last thing that they want to talk about.
And aren't we all just, and after what you've said, aren't we all just struggling with the human condition from the very beginning?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And we've all got different, we all have the same story with different ways we got there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's all the human condition, and how do we navigate that? And a big part of how we navigate is to bring it back to the stigma in the conversation. How do we talk about it?
Yeah.
Does it become a timeout? Your everything about you is wrong. Or it's like, let's get this figured out, you know, because we're all different. Here's the thing, Daniel, what we're looking at 7.5 billion people in the world with 7.5 different sets of DNA. Yet we think we're going to treat everybody the same. You take this.
Yeah. We're going to lock you up and shove the 12 steps down your throat, and there, you're good. Right. There's a defect of character if I ever saw one.
Exactly. It makes no sense. To the point where we can laugh about it and say how ridiculous it is. But that's actually the way we do it.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and to take the deeper dive into your body, your physiology, and what's happening there, that this is what houses everything. That has to be our first step.
Our shrine. Our body is our temple. That is a very, very old cliche saying.
Yeah,
exactly. How true.
And those true things stay forever for a reason, because they're true.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that we are where you're at in our province. So mm-hmm. if somebody out there, if there's a service provider out there, also let's talk a little bit about how they can start implementing some of your practices in their clinics.
That we had probably the largest insurance carrier in the States reach out to us to do a pilot, because the physicians that contacted us say, we know the efficacy of what you're talking about. We want to prove this. So our carrier will start covering it. And if they do, then the other guys are just going to have to follow. Whether it's because they want to or not, it doesn't matter. To them, it's all about bottom line dollars and cents. You know, if their policy holders are saying, I'm going to go to these other guys because they're covering it, they're going to say, okay, we'll keep it and you can have it. So that is huge, because we didn't go to them. They came to us.
That is,
people are chatting, right? Yeah. That's a wow. People, I mean, when we got that, I was like, wow.
Yeah. If you can save the big organizations money, they want you. So good.
Bottom line. And that's the thing. I'm like, guys, at the end of this, you actually saved money, because so much earlier in the game, you got this person optimized to what they had to work with. It's going to cost you less dollars in the end. If that's all you care about, cool story, you're going to save money. Right? That's it. So the fact that they came to us was beyond big.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's chatting. People are, they're taking notice. They all want to save money. You're going to save money. So service providers, it's, you know, start with the pilot program. Mm-hmm. Do a pilot program. Show the efficacy. Then say, gosh, you know what? We need this. Not because our society will be better, because isn't that what we all want? But if all you want is more money in your pocket at the end, you're going to wind up with more money in your pocket in the end.
Yeah. Yeah. Now you talk about it and you talk about we. What is it? What are you doing? What is it called, so people can look it up?
Oh, sure. I guess that makes sense to say that instead of So we started out as we.
Who is we and what is it?
So started out as Wired for Addiction, which we still are in one of our companies. And that's more having to do with the criminal justice system, because that's where it started in the criminal justice system.
Oh, let's take a pause right there. Mm-hmm. Unpack that. What do you mean?
It was, if recidivism is constant, doesn't it make sense while you have someone in a place where they can't get out of, to say, let's make changes within this individual, so when they get out, they're not back 5 minutes later.
Uh-huh.
Right? So that's where we started. And then the stigma of the addiction, Wired for Addiction, people started saying, you know, I'm listening to you and, you know, gosh, you resonate with me, with my loved ones. And I don't think I'm quite at that addicted part of things yet, but you talk about there's a spectrum. Uh-huh. Like, can I be helped? I'm like, yes, because the spectrum is the living in between. It's that anxiety. It's that depression. It's that ADD. It's all those labels that we talked about. That mm-hmm. self-medication begins there. You know, no one wakes up one day saying, hey, I can't wait to lose my family, my friends, my home, my job. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen that way. It's one little step at a time. And then that day you wake up and say, wow, right? Mm-hmm. So we became wired biohealth because we were looking at how you're wired and we're yeah. all unique.
Are you still doing this work in prisons? Is this the work that you're currently doing? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, just because of what's currently topical, yeah. in Central Canada is the topic about coercion, about forcing people into treatment. And when they're in prison, making them do programming, things like that. And you're talking about that you're doing this and you're seeing success and you're having insurance agencies reach out to you. I think we should have more talks about this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's the, look, you said coercion. It's like, it shouldn't even be coercion. It should be.
How can we help you?
Exactly. How did you get here? Tell me about you. Tell me about everything that happened in your life to get you to the point of being here, because you don't want to be here. We don't want to see you here.
Yeah.
You know, we're all made up differently and we've got to take a look at how you're made up, because it can be optimized. And it doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with you. It means every single one of us have strengths and weaknesses in life.
Yeah.
That applies the same to our physiology. And when you explain it to somebody like that, it's like, man, you know, you're right. Like, let's do it. Let's do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Got another comment coming in here. Clean and Sober Nation again. Thank you. They say, we facilitate person-centered, strength-based groups for justice-involved community members directly at our local Department of Probation. We have found that the 12-step engagement is the least viable. Barb says, it is difficult to reduce recidivism with privatized prison. Is it difficult to reduce recidivism with privatized prisons in the U.S.? Ours are still public in Canada, but they are subcontracting almost all services.
Yep. Barbie went right for the jugular. Yes, it's difficult.
Yeah, she'll do that.
Because it's on it. I'm being honest. It's difficult because in these privatized systems, people are making a lot of money.
Yeah.
And if part of their business model is not to have these people come back again, it's a difficult conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Do they necessarily want to hear what I'm saying? You know, but we just keep on going. We just keep on going until we have the person that does want to hear it. And oftentimes it's family members reaching out to us directly saying our loved one is going to be getting out in whatever time frame. This is always how the conversation goes. They've done this before, turnstile. We want this time to be different. Can you help them in the prison? And the answer is yes. We reach out to the mental health team there, say, this is what we want to do. We're going to give you the lab panels, get the samples collected. We're going to go through and they're cooperative. Why? Because they have such difficult jobs and they're like, if our job could be easier because these folks are easier to manage, doesn't it make sense for everyone? So oftentimes it's the loved ones that bring light to that particular prison
mm-hmm.
to say, you know, this makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible. You have effectively blown my mind on this Friday morning, Evelyn, because I like before the show, I was talking like, oh, can we talk about this? Can we talk about, you know, the unhoused and you know, the, all of the things that are topical in the news right now. And you just like, you kind of overarched it with something I didn't really see coming. And like, you're like, oh yeah, it started in the criminal justice system. And I was like, whoa. Hang on, slow down. What does that mean?
And that's always how the conversations go, Daniel. I'll just be like, yeah, okay, let's talk. And then once I start talking, I'm like, yeah, it applies to this. It applies to this. It applies to this. And people have no idea. So thank you for asking the engaging questions that gets it out of me to say, yeah, here's all the places. Effectively, it's everybody, being an individual that comes to us, a loved one that comes to us, a group that comes to us, someone that wants to do a pilot for a large group that comes to us. It's everything, everybody. Why? Because as you said, the human condition, it affects everybody.
I forget which philosopher said it, but he said, we're all just trying to walk each other home. Cool. All right, Evelyn, thanks so much. I'm sure that I would love to have you back. We'll cut you loose. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us this morning, and take care.
Thank you.
Okay, if you got anything out of this, please hit that like button at the bottom of the screen. If you are not yet subscribed to us on YouTube, please hit that subscribe button. We go live every Friday morning, every Sunday evening, and that might change. So we try to go live as much as we can. So stay tuned. That's all I got. Take care, everyone.
Say, this is Hard Knocks Talks.